Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
It's tax season. You're standing at your mailbox, pulling out your W-2s, your 1099s, and you sigh. Because yes, taxes are the price we pay for a civilized society. You can credit U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes for that one. It's also carved over the entrance to the IRS's HQ in Washington. But is everyone who's enjoying the fruits of this civilization actually paying fairly for it? Democratic lawmakers don't think so.
No billionaire should be paying a lower tax rate than a school teacher or firefighter.
Okay, so let me be clear. We are talking rates here, not absolute dollars, okay? So let's set that aside. But have you ever wondered how that happens? It's not like there's a paragraph on page 5473 of the United States tax code that says, to achieve the billionaire deduction, do this. Nah, it's way more interesting than that. You see, billionaire tax avoidance is, in its own way, a celebration of American ingenuity. Ideas are brainstormed in that laboratory of fiscal experimentation, the tax attorney's office, and then they're unleashed into the wild. And then attorneys and their clients watched from behind their moneyed blinds. Will the new mechanism thrive in the real world? Will the IRS shut it down? Will Congress wipe it away? Will a court? And what happens when none of those things take place? How many billions of dollars go unpaid virtually forever? Well, it turns out it's a lot. And today, we are going to show you how. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
People had clients who wanted to reduce their taxes, and this was a great way to do it. It's that simple.
Well, this is Richard Covey. He served as special tax counsel to the American Banking Association for more than 25 years. Now, we couldn't tell if it's because he's just a generally happy dude, or if the story he told us is just that absurd, or if he can't believe what he invented has been as successful as it is. But when we talked with him, Richard Covey laughed a lot.
And to my surprise, continues to work today.
Richard Covey helped develop something called a GRAT. Now, I'll decipher that acronym a bit later. But the story begins in the 1980s. We'll pick it up with what happened a bit later. In 1993, Covey was going around the country discussing how GRATs might be used.
At one of those speeches, a lawyer who came to it came up to me and he said, would you be willing to work with me for one of my clients? And I said, sure.
That client was Audrey Walton of the Walmart Waltons. Okay, so what does a GRAT do?
The result of it was you could retain 100% of the value of the trust. And that's what was behind the Walton case, which we won in the tax court. And as a result of that, people could create million-dollar trusts. They could create billion-dollar trusts, and there still wouldn't be any tax when you use the treasury table that wiped out the full value of the retained interests.
Yep, you heard that correctly. You can create billion-dollar trusts where the tax on it is a giant goose egg. Well, the IRS did take Audrey Walton to court for using Richard Covey's idea to shelter her assets, but the court decided with Audrey Walton.
It's been accepted as working and continues to work today. People had clients who wanted to reduce their taxes, and this was a great way to do it. It's that simple. It doesn't take long for one of those ideas to get around when you have a case right on point.
And that's exactly what happened. In the decades since, grats have become a beloved way of putting billions of dollars out of reach of the IRS and therefore out of reach of your United States Treasury.
The grat concept, though, it works whether you put in $100,000 or you put in $100 million. If you're successful, it works, and it just simply means the people who put in more are obviously more successful.
There's that laugh again. Now, we're going to hear more from Mr. Covey in a bit, but we have to pause here for a moment because tax attorneys tend to speak in a somewhat rarefied language. But we have an interpreter here with us who's going to help us better understand the natural history of the grat. Zach Miter joins us. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News. Hello there, Zach.
How do you do?
I'm doing well. So, first of all, tell us more about Richard Covey. Who is he?
Yeah, so Richard Covey's a longtime tax lawyer and who you know represents wealthy clients and helps them prepare their taxes. And he lives in this sort of world of tax planning, which is kind of, to some degree, a euphemism for figuring out how to avoid paying taxes or to pay as low as possible.
Pretty good line of work, if you can get it here. So the story actually really begins, as I understand it, back in the 1980s, 1984 to be exact, because that's when Richard Covey just came up with this idea of something that was later known as a GRIT, or a Grantor Retained Income Trust. And he told us about it.
Common law GRIT was simply a person creates a trust for himself, retains the right to keep the income for a number of years, retains a couple of other rights which have value for transfer tax purposes, and therefore he pays a gift tax when the trust is created on only a portion of the trust.
So, Zach, decipher that for us. What is he talking about?
Sure. So we're talking here about the estate and gift tax system, which is, the estate tax is basically a special tax. It's different from the income tax that applies to kind of large fortunes when they pass down from one generation to generation. And what Covey developed was this kind of cool idea for how you could create a trust that would sort of appear to involve a very small gift to your heirs, but in fact would transfer a large amount of money. And the technical way it would achieve that is you would not pay tax up front on the let's see if I can get this right here. I'm already getting a little confused. you wouldn't count the income that this the expected income that this thing was going to generate, which was theoretically very large. But then you would actually invest it in things that didn't produce any taxable income, say, for instance, stocks that didn't pay dividends, right? And so over time, that would kind of accumulate in the trust in a way that was kind of counter to what the IRS formula would have predicted. And so you would essentially find a way of making a large gift to your heirs appear very small.
Yes. So that's exactly how Covey described it to us, that essentially the mechanism he created undervalued the remaining interest or value of the trust, which is why you got away with not paying as much or any taxes at all. Now, he also told us, Zach, he was frank about sort of the political climate at the time, which sort of helped him launch the concept of the grit into the world. And here's what he said.
You started this movement, I would say in the late 70s and early 80s, of using a trust offensively to accomplish things that would save estate taxes. It's not only the common law grit and the grat that did it. There was some other things that were mentioned in practical drafting. And then there were the family limited partnerships where people started to use a partnership as a way of reducing your estate taxes.
So, Zach, Covey described to us a shift in using trusts offensively rather than defensively to protect assets. Do you think that's important?
Yeah, so I think when a lot of people think about trusts, if they think about them at all, they think of maybe, you know, an heir who receives something, but they're too young to make good decisions about it, so they have an older trustee to kind of keep an eye on it until they come of age, things like that. There's all kinds of reasons why people have trusts. They go back to the Middle Ages that have nothing to do with tax. But what Covey is talking about is sort of like using that mechanism to sort of, you know, offensively go out and achieve some tax goals of like, you know, essentially giving money to your heirs without paying the tax that would otherwise be due on it by, you know, kind of manipulating some aspect of the tax code to kind of, you know, slide it through.
Well, so that's the real key thing as far as I understand it, that it's this idea that, okay, well, previously we had thought that eventually when someone dies, some sort of tax will be paid to the federal government. But the offensive use of trust, as Richard Covey described, the point was to erase that eventuality, right? And so we're going to talk a little bit more about how that happens, because the IRS eventually comes around and says, well, this whole grit idea, we don't like it, not a good idea, abusive use of it. And then Congress steps in. What does Congress do, Zach?
Yeah, so Congress, you know, recognized, this was well publicized in the 80s, that people were doing this. I mean, Covey had, I think, published a paper to talk about how it could be done. And Congress stepped in and said, you know, we're going to have to change the law to make it so that particular abuse is not possible. So they passed a law in 1990 that ended the grit as we know it. So it wasn't really possible after that to do the exact thing that Covey had come up with.
But then they did something else, right?
Oh, yeah. Something much, much better.
We'll talk about that when we come back, because today we're understanding the natural history of one of the favorite tax avoidance tools of America's ultra rich. We're going to teach you how they do it. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about a species of tax avoidance called the grantor-retained annuity trust. Essentially, we're going through the natural history of this favored tax avoidance tool of America's billionaires, and we're going to teach you how they use it. And I'm joined today by Zach Mitre. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News. Okay, so Zach, what happened after Richard Covey's original idea of the grit was basically shunned by Congress? What did Congress do?
So Congress passes a law in 1990 that specifically targets the abuse that it saw in Covey's grit, which was the trust he came up with in the 80s. They said, you can't do that anymore. New set of rules, so that particular trick doesn't work anymore.
So here's what Richard Covey then told us about what Congress made instead, right? Because they created a new option in the grits to replace the grit. Is that right, Zach?
Yeah, they basically said, if you want to do something like that that's not an abuse of the tax code, we're going to invent our own sort of, you know, officially sanctioned thing called a grat, which doesn't have any of those abuse potentials that we were so worried about in the grit.
Okay, and so the grat is that grantor retained annuity trust. So Congress says, here, this is something that's legal. You can't abuse it. Go ahead and use it in your in your tax filings. Okay, but here's what Richard Covey told us about the problems with the grat.
They made a very serious drafting error. They didn't realize that they were still permitting you to create a grantor retained annuity trust, let's say, where you value the retained interest at the full value of the trust virtually. And because of that mistake, the grant really grew up.
So, Zach, though, who's the they? Who actually wrote or created the grant in Congress?
Yeah, so it was, you know, it ultimately comes down to some lawyers who work for the, you know, the tax writing committees in the House and the Senate. And I spoke to a few of the folks who actually worked on those in those jobs in the, you know, the lead up to the 1990 legislation. And, you know, some of them were pretty junior folks who've gone on to do other things outside of the tax world.
Junior folks, though? What does that mean, Zach?
Yeah, I mean, they weren't that long out of law school, right? These were, you know, sort of like a chance to be a congressional aide for a few years, that kind of thing.
I don't mean to laugh, but what you're saying is congressional aides, you know, hardworking as they might be, are the ones who came up with the language on behalf of actual members of Congress saying, here's a legal way for a new form of trust for billionaires to use. Okay, so again, might be just out of law school, might be super hardworking, but it sounds like they didn't actually realize what they had done, which Richard Covey said they had given him and other tax attorneys a giant loophole to use now with the grant. And here's what he told us.
The result of it was you could retain 100% of the value of the trust, and that's what was behind the Walton case, which we won in the tax court. And as a result of that, people could create million-dollar trusts. They could create billion-dollar trusts, and there still wouldn't be any tax when you use the Treasury table that wiped out the full value of the retained interests.
So billion-dollar trusts or multi-billion-dollar trusts with no tax. Okay, I want to pull Bob Lord into this conversation. Now he's a senior advisor of tax policy at the Patriotic Millionaires. Bob, welcome.
Hi, Magna.
Okay, but if I understand correctly, Bob, you were once a tax attorney yourself. Is that right?
I was.
Okay, so when did you first hear of the grant?
Oh, I can't remember exactly when, but it would have been sometime in the 90s.
In the 90s. Okay, so you decipher for us, what is Richard Covey describing that the grant actually does? Because I keep saying it effectively is a tool where billionaires can hold back billions of dollars in a trust from taxation. It sounds like kind of forever.
Well, yeah. And I think if you to understand it economically, you can actually put aside the concept of a trust and annuity payments. What's really going on is this. I take assets and I sell them to my kids. And we agree that they're going to pay me the purchase price of those assets solely out of the assets or the income from the assets. And so if the assets don't perform well, I wind up taking all of the assets back and it just counts as a nothing for tax purposes. But if the assets perform really well, then they get to keep part of the assets and it's not a gift. And so what happens over time, and this can be done over and over and over again. So what happens over time is my kids become the best investors in the world because everything they buy and hold onto goes up in value. And I become the worst investor in the world because everything I wind up holding onto loses value. And over time, I can transfer pretty much my entire estate, even a $1 billion estate, over to them.
Wait. So essentially, because everything that you, I'm trying to imagine this like on a whiteboard in my head, right? So because you are holding on to assets that are losing value, that's easily understood. You're not paying taxes on assets that are losing value, correct?
Right. Well, and my wealth is decreasing while theirs is increasing over time.
Okay. But I suppose I still don't quite understand why they're not paying taxes on their increasing wealth.
Well, we've got two tax systems going on here. One's the income tax system and one is the estate tax system. And for income tax purposes, none of this counts. They're all still my assets for income tax purposes. But for For estate tax purposes, and gift tax purposes, what's happening is they're buying assets, and they're agreeing to pay 100% of the value back to me, but only out of the assets or the income from the assets. So if the assets do well, they'll pay me 100% of that purchase price, but they'll have something left over. So it's not a gift. They paid 100% of the value.
I see. Okay. Now, when you were back in your tax attorney days, when you had first heard of the GRAT or it became sort of more common, did you use it for some of your clients?
I think I only, like, one or two times did I set up GRATs, because really it's only when you get up in to kind of the stratosphere of estate tax avoidance planning that the GRAT really becomes necessary. There are other techniques that can be used for the moderately wealthy client. And most of what I did, the great, great majority of what I did, was for the moderately wealthy.
What are we talking about moderately, like hundreds of millions?
No. This is the world we live in now, that hundreds of millions is only moderately wealthy. No, I'm talking about $5 or $10 million.
Oh, okay. That still sounds like a lot to me. But point taken. Yeah. Now, let me ask you, though, give me an example for those stratospherically rich Americans who have successfully used a GRAT. How much tax have they avoided paying?
Oh, well, Zach and I each have uncovered through SEC filings some fairly enormous tax savings through GRATs. He looked at Sheldon Adelson back, and I think it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, Zach, like the early 2000s. That's right. I looked at Phil Knight going from 2009 to 2016. And in the case of Phil Knight, I think it was about $6 or $7 billion that he transferred to his descendants through GRATs, without paying any estate or gift tax.
Wow, that's a lot of Nikes. Okay, Zach.
That's right. And Sheldon Adelson, who is the Las Vegas Sands owner, it was as far as we could tell, it was in the neighborhood of at least $8 billion. So if you kind of assume the estate tax would have been 40%, you're talking about almost $3 billion of taxes avoided.
Wow. And these are for just individual – those are just two families that you both talked about. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
And Meghna, those are – we could find out about those because of the SEC filings. I think that the potential for someone whose wealth is privately held entities – where there aren't any SEC filings, and particularly where the holding is not in a corporation that itself pays tax, I think the potential for avoidance is way higher there. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that there are situations where the amount avoided is well into the tens of billions.
Wow. Okay, so Zach, let me also just get one other detail here about how the GRAT works. Because I think Richard Covey told us that you do take some risk here, because you have to decide, you have to think about what assets might rise in value and what might decline in value while you're alive. But you can also make one GRAT after another, after another, after another. Is that right?
Yeah, and in fact, that's the sort of right way to do it, as it were, because you can GRATs tend to last at least 2 years, and so if you think about it, every GRAT is like a 2 year bet that's basically heads I win, tails I don't lose. Heads I get some tax avoidance, tails I don't. I'm back where I started. And so if you can get enough of those going at once, you know, the first one pays you back something after a year, you can immediately put those assets into another one and keep it going. And so you're constantly making new bets. It's basically you're getting free lottery tickets from the IRS for tax avoidance. And you want to get as many as possible, because they won't all pay off.
Okay. And you can ostensibly do this for a long, long time, which is what keeps the money out of reach of the IRS for I keep saying forever, but I'm not sure that's right, Zach.
So what it allows you to do, the estate tax is kind of like a toll booth on the highway. But when you pass assets down from one generation to the next, if they're in the billions of dollars, the government has a tax that's due. And this just kind of allows you to avoid that toll booth and put it into your kids' hands and let them do whatever they want with it without paying that tax.
Okay. So listen, even though Congress created this, or those hardworking congressional aides that you told us about, Zach, the IRS eventually, in 2000, excuse me, I'm still trying to overcome a cold here, but in 2000, the IRS was like, hey, no, this is not good. Your billionaires are avoiding paying a lot of taxes. And that was the Walton case that Richard Covey was telling us about. And so he described to us sort of how he felt when the IRS took him and Audrey Walton to court.
We were confident when we wrote the brief in the principles that could apply and that you could, so to speak, zero out a grant. And there was some authority, although there wasn't a lot on it, that said you could. And that was it.
Okay, so Bob Lord, the reason why I wanted to play this is because it sounds like kind of an innocuous little moment of Richard Covey being like, oh, we felt good about it. But when he says that there was some authority to justify the existence of the grant, but there wasn't a lot on it. I mean, by definition, that's because there was no case law on something that had only come into existence a couple of years earlier. And the reason why I want to point that out is, isn't that kind of de facto the case for every new tax avoidance vehicle that's ever been created? And so when it finally ends up in court, there is we put a lot on the shoulders of judges to make determinations about the legality of new tax avoidance vehicles, but they have very little to go on.
Oh, absolutely. Tax avoidance planners work in the gray area where the law is not well defined.
And so therefore, who has the advantage when these cases go to court?
The the taxpayer, I think, because the taxpayer has very, very good tax lawyers and can pay these tax lawyers very, very well. The IRS is really, especially at the top end, understaffed. There aren't that many folks at the IRS who have the skills and the knowledge to go after these things.
Okay. So Richard Covey also told us then what happened with the case when the IRS took them to court. So here's the first bit of what he said.
We used this with Mrs. Walton, and the IRS objected to our valuation, and then we went through the tax court, and surprisingly, the Treasury never proposed that we settle a case, so it got tried. The whole tax court reviewed it, which was not unique, recognizing what was involved in it. And to my surprise, there was not even a dissent. The whole tax court agreed with it. So there it is.
So because Congress created it and then the entire tax court said, yep, this is legal, not even a single dissent, that really pushed the grant out of the gates and into usage amongst those stratospherically rich, as Bob Lord describes. And here's what Richard Covey told us.
It's been accepted as working and continues to work today. People had clients who wanted to reduce their taxes, and this was a great way to do it. It's that simple. It doesn't take long for one of those ideas to get around when you have a case right on point.
Bob Lord, is this usually how it happens? That, like, there's just the creation of a new tax avoidance concept, and then it gets sent out there to see what happens. How often do these things actually get shut down?
Well, I think the way the system should work is you're going to have the clever lawyers out there who create these strategies. But where it broke down here wasn't so much the tax court decision. I don't think the tax court decision is all that surprising. What's surprising is that the tax court decision came down in 2000. That's about 22 years ago. And nothing's been done since then by Congress to close down the loophole. Because the way it's supposed to work is someone is real clever. They create a loophole, goes to tax court. Sometimes they lose, and then the loophole is shut down by the tax court. Sometimes they win, and then Congress has to jump in and close the loophole. And that didn't happen here.
Well, we're going to talk about why when we come back. So Bob Lord with the Patriotic Millionaires and Zach Mitre at Bloomberg News. Hang on here for just a second. We're getting a lesson. This is class today on how billionaires invent new ways to avoid taxes and then get the imprimatur from both Congress and the courts. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are investigating what I've been calling the natural history of a favored tax avoidance mechanism of America's multi-billionaires. It's called the GRAT, or the Grantor Retained Annuity Trust, and we've been learning about how it was created, what Congress did when it first found out about it, and then what happened when the IRS took the users of these GRATs to court. Well, what happened is the court sided with a particular billionaire, Audrey Walton. So we're joined today by Bob Lord. He's senior advisor of tax policy at the Patriotic Millionaires. And Zach Mitre is with us as well. He's reporter for Bloomberg News. And we're going to come back to what we can learn from the story of the GRAT. But there are just so many interesting ways, fascinating ways, that those with the know-how can, massage the U.S. tax code, that once you start learning about them, it's hard not to want to talk about other examples. So here's one more example of how the rich successfully avoid taxes.
I think there's a great discussion to be had about who should pay how much taxes. I personally would be fine with paying more.
So that enthusiastic, I want to pay more, came from former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer. He was on The Daily Show back in 2019. Now, what had happened is that at that time, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, had recently introduced a tax plan commonly known as the ultra-millionaire tax.
Yes,
I think the most important thing, frankly, is that people just get the numbers. Look at what's going on today.
Right.
And then you can almost like assign a quota. You should pay this much tax, you should pay that, but it's got to be based on what we want to do. What do we want to do with the money? How much? Who can pay?
Right.
What other expenses can we cut? Just get it right. And then the will of the people will decide what should happen, and I'll be okay with it.
Okay, well, so let's try to look at what happened, because in 2021, ProPublica examined Steve Ballmer's tax data. And according to that analysis, in 2018, Ballmer reported making over $650 million. So what was his tax rate on that?
Do you pay a higher tax rate than your assistants?
Do I pay a higher tax rate than my assistants? No, I do not.
In fact, that year, Ballmer paid $78 million in taxes. That's approximately 12% of those earnings. So again, the rate versus the absolute dollar. And the story of how he did that, how he got that low rate, actually begins 4 years earlier when Steve Ballmer bought the NBA team in LA, the Clippers, for $2 billion.
Did you watch these guys? That was hardcore! Hardcore, baby! I'll boldly say the Clippers will win many, 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 many more Larrys in the next 26 than the last 26.
Okay, so Steve Ballmer loves basketball. That's totally cool. But he also loves how much taxes he saved by buying an NBA team because, broadly speaking, when you purchase a business, you're able to write off almost the entire price of your purchase over the span of 15 years. So, Bob Lord, though, let me turn to you. That also applies when you buy a professional sports team?
Yes, it does.
So what happened with Ballmer and the Clippers?
Well, whatever, I don't know the details of that purchase, but whatever the purchase price was, most of it was allocated to what we call intangible assets, things like goodwill of the business. And the rules are, under the tax code, that you can write off, you can deduct the intangible asset cost over 15 years.
Okay. Well, so I'll give you some of the details because thanks to ProPublica, we have them. And then you can help me understand the implications, okay? Because in 2017, Steve Ballmer reported that the Clippers lost $140 million. Okay, that's what he reported to the IRS. But later on, leaked data actually from the NBA found that the team had actually made $2.1 million. So they had made money rather than lost it. But overall, ProPublica estimates that by 2021, Steve Ballmer saved $145 million in taxes from his ownership of the Clippers. Meanwhile, his net worth has grown to $85.3 billion, which is, more than a 300% increase from when he first bought the team about a decade ago. Okay, but Bob, let me, on behalf of anyone who owns any kind of assets, the depreciation of that asset is an accepted tax practice from everything from NBA teams to common home ownership. So what's the problem here?
Well, the problem with the sports teams is that the asset, the goodwill of the business, isn't really declining in value. A lot of times it's going up in value. In fact, most of the time it's going up in value. So this deduction from income that's being taken isn't real. There's no real loss in value. And here's where it gets a whole lot worse, Magna. Let's say a billionaire buys a sports team and holds it for 15 years and takes all these deductions for the amortization of these of the goodwill and other intangible assets, and then dies. And then what happens is that billionaire spouse or children inherit the sports team, and they get to revalue, without paying any income tax, all those intangible assets, and they get to start the amortization process all over again.
This sounds a lot like what happens with investment real estate, right? The depreciation period is, 27 years. And the reason why I mentioned that is because I actually misspoke earlier. When I said we get those same tax benefits from common home ownership, I should have been specific and said investment real estate, right? So like when things level up to what they are when the predecessor dies, you get a whole free run of many years ahead of you to save money. But again, I keep wondering, like, yes, I understand that it feels unfair, but a lot of people from this particular example are benefiting from it. It's just like some are benefiting more, Bob. So what's the problem with that?
Well, I don't know if because people are benefiting from it tax-wise, it's justifiable. And that's especially true in the case of these sports teams. Look, in the real estate context, at least in the long run, if it's a building, at some point down the line, in most cases, it does wind up having to be raised and rebuilt. So there is real economic depreciation over in the long run there. with the sports teams, that's just not the case, and they're being written off over a shorter period of time, only 15 years.
Okay. So, look, I'm running to the defense of America's multi-billionaires because it's my job to try to present questions that that probe at different points of view here, but I'm also still wanting to just underscore that we're talking about vast amounts of money that are not ending up back in the United States Treasury, that are not being folded back into this country to support the cost of civilization, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said earlier. So, but Zach Mitre, let me turn back to you. It seems as if then what we're learning through this class today, essentially, is that it's not that hard. If you've got some pretty smart tax attorneys, new ways to avoid taxes can be pretty easily created. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, I think it's particularly true with the estate tax, which is what the GRAT is designed to fight. The famous quote from one of Trump's top advisors, Gary Cohn, was that only morons pay the estate tax. In other words, it's so easy to avoid that. If you pay it, it's just because you weren't paying attention, basically.
Okay, so this leads me to wonder then, why in the late 80s and in 1990 was Congress willing to do something about Coby's first trust mechanism, the GRIT, right? When they turned back the GRIT in 1990, as you told us, Zach, but the GRAT's still, going strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and I think what you can see is that what changed is that the Republican Party, I think, largely kind of starting in the 90s, really decided to try to end the estate tax. It became kind of a part of the Republican platform, like, let's just get rid of it. And so, where in the past you might have had a bipartisan consensus to like, let's close these little loopholes every once in a while. That kind of went out the window because the Republicans said, why would we try to fix a system that we're trying to just get rid of completely? And so they weren't nearly as interested in the 1990s in like doing these kind of maintenance loophole fixers in the tax code. Because they said, let's just wipe the whole thing out.
Mm, okay. So we asked Richard Covey, I'm going to call him the grandfather of the GRAT, what he thought about Congress's actions back in 1990 and its lack of action now. And he did point to the fact that there has been this big change in the viewpoint of around the estate tax. So here's what he said.
The Republicans who oppose transfer taxes in general, obviously liked it. And you had obviously some wealthy Democrats who liked the idea too. So there it is. When they were talking about changing the law a couple of years ago, it still did not get knocked out, although they've tried to indirectly affect it by some of the proposals they made that didn't get through. And there we are here, for the last 25 years, people can do this. And from the standpoint of tax policy, it's very bad.
I find it remarkable that Richard Covey, he says, from the standpoint of tax policy, this thing that I helped create is very bad. And in fact, it's been around for 33 years now. So we asked him, does he ever think that the GRAT loophole will be closed?
Oh, sure. It's a matter of time. My guess would be that if you get a Democratic administration in and they've got, control of Congress, it'll get knocked out. But I do think that obviously there are some Democrats who have created GRATs and, in this one area, they're with the Republicans. They'd like to see the GRAT successful, too.
So, Bob Lord, I mean, Richard Covey says, sure, it'll happen in a matter of time. Do you feel as optimistic?
Yes and no. Okay. I do think we're moving in the right direction. But gosh, it sure is slow. We did have legislation that got through the House Ways and Means Committee back in 2021 that would have indirectly pretty much closed the grout loophole. And there are proposals out there now to do that. There's been so far no Republican support for closing the loophole. And there are Democrats who have been on the side of keeping the loopholes open and in some cases repealing the estate tax altogether.
What is this costing us? Let me ask you, what do you think this is costing us morally, Bob? Because, I mean, it seems as if we continue to facilitate the creation of these new tax avoidance vehicles, I mean, are we on the way to eventually seeing a trillion-dollar family, Bob?
Oh, I think we're well on the way. I think that there's these things called dynasty trusts where the wealth has already been protected from any estate or gift or something called the generation skipping trust forever. And so those trusts will just grow in value without what Zach termed the toll booth, without having to pay the toll charge at the passage of each generation. So look, in just 40 years ago, the wealthiest Americans had net worths of $1 or $2 billion, and now they have net worths of $1 or $200 billion. So you don't have to extrapolate very far from here to get to the trillion-dollar mark. What to me is the most troublesome is that if our tax system's working appropriately, the concentration of wealth, the share of the wealth that's held by those at the very, very top will be maintained at a reasonable level. We're just way off the mark at this point. We have the top 0.1% of households with about 20% of the nation's wealth. And the only way we can address that is by taxing the intergenerational transmission of wealth, from one generation to the next. And as we've discussed for the last hour, we're not doing that efficiently at all. Or we can tax the wealth itself. We're not doing that. Or we can tax what I call the real economic income, the growth of wealth. And we don't do that either. What we have really in America is a wage tax, not an income tax. If you get a W-2, it's pretty darn hard to avoid taxes. But if you have income in the form of asset value growth, you know, you founded Amazon and you invested very little and now it's worth $100 billion, that type of income doesn't get taxed.
Right. So this is why we hear some lawmakers keep saying we're taxing work, not wealth. But Zach Mitre, we have 30 seconds left here. I'm seeing the top estate tax rate having dropped, you know, some 30% over the past couple of decades. Is there even just turning that around? Does it seem to be a possibility in the next couple of election cycles? I don't know.
It's hard to say. I mean, we had a chance in Build Back Better to do exactly that and to strengthen the estate tax a little bit, and it was Democrats who couldn't, you know, reach a consensus about it. That's the reason why that didn't become law.
Well, as we learned today, with tools that creative people can come up with, like the GRAT, I mean, we could be on the way to trillion-dollar American families. Amazing. Zach Mitre, reporter for Bloomberg News, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Bob Lord, senior advisor of tax policy at the Patriotic Millionaires. Bob, thank you as well.
Thanks.
I honestly love classes like this. I hope you enjoyed it too. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.